Department of Education to continue its clampdown on Palestine solidarity in British schools after denying permission for a judicial review brought by human rights group CAGE. The legal challenge was in relation to a discriminatory letter sent to schools by then Education Minister Gavin Williamson, which gave instructions to schools on how to present the occupation of Palestine and recommended schools work with three specific organizations to deliver a balanced presentation of the issue. As this program pointed out some months ago, none of the three organizations provide balanced or truthful accounts of the occupation of Palestine. In fact, every one of them has a covert Zionist agenda. Solutions, Not Sides, a project of One Voice, a group set up by prominent Zionists. Our research shows that multiple staff members have previously worked for the Israeli regime, including for the occupation forces. Some worked in Zionist intelligence, others worked for Israel at the same time as working for One Voice. Forum for Discussion of Israel and Palestine. This is a group pushing Zionist narratives set up by an organization called the Council of Christians and Jews. This is a long-standing pro-Israel grouping which has overlapping personnel with FODIP, though they claim to be independent. Community Security Trust, a group that claims to combat anti-Semitism in the UK, but which purposely blurs together anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism in pursuit of Israel's foreign policy objectives. Its charitable objectives include combating extremism. However, its founder, the convicted fraudster Gerald Ronson, has a record of funding extremist Zionist groups such as Shabad through his family foundation. It seems that bias in favor of the racist ideology of Zionism is regarded as acceptable in schools, whereas standing up for Palestinian rights is not. CAGE found multiple cases where school kids have been punished, disciplined, or prohibited even from the mildest display of solidarity with Palestine. These include the school that banned the colors of the Palestinian flag or any clothing resembling Middle Eastern clothes, the student who was referred to Prevent after emailing videos of Islamic lectures to his school to express his unhappiness at a one-sided presentation on Israel-Palestine, the students who were suspended for wearing a Palestine badge to school or for discussing Palestine. In response to the judge's decision on the letter from the Education Secretary, CAGE released a summary of responses to a survey on the Ukraine. This showed that just like the support for Zionism, most schools have been supporting the NATO proxy war in Ukraine, with schools bedecked with Ukraine flags and fundraisers openly supported by schools. Of course, the idea of raising money for Palestine is regarded as controversial, and students are disciplined for raising the issue.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Fahad Ansari, who we spoke to earlier via Skype. Fahad is a consultant in immigration and public law departments at the Duncan Lewis Solicitors. He's got extensive experience in all aspects of asylum, immigration and nationality law, as well as on terrorism and national security. Fahad regularly writes about current affairs and he frequently provides expert commentary on legal developments for numerous broadcast outlets, including the BBC, Sky News, CNN and Al Jazeera. Welcome to the show. I asked Fahad earlier what the legal grounds were on which CAGE took this case to judicial review.
Three primary grounds on which we argue that the letter that the then Education Secretary Gavin Williamson sent to schools was unlawful. The first one was that he had breached the Education Act by asking schools to take a politically partisan view on a subject matter, namely the Israel-Palestine conflict. And specifically, he had asked schools or directed schools not to work with or use materials by any external organizations that publicly rejected Israel's right to exist. Now, the right to exist is not a legal one, it's a political one, that is used to justify Israel's creation and its current policies and practices. As such, there are two legitimate opinions on whether it does have a right to exist or whether it doesn't have a right to exist. And while the government has its view on the matter, it's prohibited from compelling schools to adopt that view and teach that view. And what Gavin Williamson sought to do with his instruction to schools was completely sideline one of those views as unacceptable. So that breached the principle of political indoctrination in schools and breach of the Education Act. So that was the first ground of challenge. The second ground was that it did not accept the views of Muslim students and the Islamophobia that they had been subjected to in the wake of the conflict, focusing only on the situation of Jewish pupils who had been subjected to anti-Semitism. And in doing so, it discriminated against Muslim students. And finally, we argued that while there was no duty on the education secretary to consult stakeholders, once he had done so with a stakeholder, he was under a duty to conduct that exercise fairly and involve other stakeholders. And what seemed to have happened, he only conducted a consultation with one specific group and nobody else.
David, what do you know about the organisations that Gavin Williamson recommended should go into schools? I mean, tell us about particularly this Solutions Not Sides organisation. I mean, does it have a covert Zionist agenda, do you think?
Yes, it does. Solutions Not Sides is a project which was set up by another organisation called One Voice, which, as is mentioned in the film, but which we've done quite a lot of research on, was set up by a guy who's boasted that his activities were anti-BDS before anyone had even heard of BDS. So this is a Zionist organisation aiming to pursue the state interests of Israel and using as cover the idea that we should have solutions in the conflict, that there are not just sides, that we should really try and focus on solutions. But what they mean by solutions is not having solutions, pushing down the road the idea of a two-state solution and all that kind of thing, and definitely not supporting the Palestinians and their just struggle for their full rights.
This is very much a kind of a one-eyed approach, and it sounds like, then, from what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, Fahad has gathered evidence of numerous inappropriate interventions in schools, like banning symbols and clothing, to interfering in charitable fundraising. And I asked him to tell us some more about this.
So Cage was approached by dozens of Muslim pupils who had been reprimanded and sanctioned in a variety of ways by their schools and academies for engaging in Palestinian solidarity. This ranged from verbal warnings to physical interventions such as seizing the flag or seizing their banners, taking their badges, to more serious sanctions such as suspensions, expulsions, referral to prevent, and calling in the police to speak with the child in question. Obviously, this is ludicrous, where you have groups of children organically showing empathy towards people who are oppressed on the other side of the world in full view of the international community. And this is there. And rather than schools welcoming this act of empathy, this act of solidarity, the fact that students were politically aware, they cracked down on them with the intention that they would suppress that natural inclination to side with the oppressed against injustice.
David, the government's levelling up departments promoting, and it seems to be funding, the forum for the discussion of Israel and Palestine. I mean, is that an issue there, do you think?
Well, it's not just the question of this organisation, FODIP. It's also the question of the other organisation we've been talking about, One Voice and Solutions Not Sides. All three of these organisations, Solutions Not Sides was a project of One Voice and became notionally independent. It's still part of the same organisation. And all of them have been funded to the tune of many thousands of pounds by the Levelling Up Department. It used to be called the Department for Communities and Local Government. Mm. And these are funded under part and parcel of their sort of counter-extremism agenda. So you can see what's going on here. Is that there's an attempt to support pro-Israel narratives as if that is somehow against extremism. And what they mean by extremism, of course, is those people who are opposed to UK foreign policy, not those who support aspects of it, including the illegal parts of it, including supporting, of course, Israel in its illegal activities in the occupied territories, as, you know, detailed numerous occasions by the United Nations. So there's a push towards a particular kind of extremism, which is not thought of as extremism, which, of course, is Zionism. And there's an attempt to suggest that anyone who stands up for perfectly legitimate rights under international law for the Palestinians is somehow an extremist and is somehow supporting terrorism, which is, of course, ridiculous. Mm.
It's a curious state of affairs, isn't it? Yeah, because, I mean, we have Israel kind of in breach of international law, and somehow that's sort of beyond the pale, it seems, to... Very odd state of affairs, to say the least. I mean, we've reported, of course, haven't we, as well, on the Community Security Trust on this programme on a number of occasions. It was one of the three organisations promoted by Gavin Williamson, as you all know. I mean, can you explain how this group appears to be involved in extremism for us?
Well, the Community Security Trust does not get money from the same pot as these other two organisations, but it does get money from the government, and way more money than the other two organisations put together. So $14 million a year it gets for its activities. Now, of course, it's an organisation which deliberately blurs together anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism so that it can target the left and, indeed, Muslims in this country with spying activities and passing their information on to the security services, etc. But it's engaged in extremism. You saw a clip in the film there of Gerald Ronson. You probably couldn't have told from the clip, but he's giving an address at a national meeting, UK national meeting of Chabad Lubavitch, which is an extremist Jewish sect, which is involved, according to the Israeli intelligence agency Shin Bet, in most of the price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians in the territories, but yet has been supported by Gerald Ronson, the convicted fraudster, for, it says in the press, for more than four decades he's been supporting this extremist organisation. And his own organisation, the CST, has in its charitable objectives that it will challenge and educate about extremism. Well, it's not challenging and educating about Chabad. It is, in fact, supporting their extremism. So there we have a really clear indication of the way in which it breaches its own charitable objectives by supporting an extremist organisation, Chabad, which is involved in all sorts of appalling activities in Palestine.
Well, I also asked Fahad about schools banning Palestine as a topic on the grounds that it's too political, yet they're allowing support for the conflict in Ukraine.
Well, this is the double standard that is so blatant that every single child who was sanctioned for showing solidarity with Palestine raised the issue with their schools. And it was on the back of that that CAGE actually began compiling information and data from these students as to how their schools operated vis-a-vis the Ukraine situation, and then contrasted that with how they behaved last year with Palestinian solidarity. I think what's really interesting is the solidarity of Palestine was very organic. It was not dictated to them by schools or by anybody. It was just a raw, natural reaction that schools did not tolerate and the government did not tolerate. Yet when it came to Ukraine, while the situations have parallels, schools and the government felt they needed to dictate to the pupils how to actually behave in the situation and that they should show solidarity. So students were encouraged to bring in Ukrainian flags, pupils were fundraising for Ukraine. I remember one of the case studies that I came across in the CAGE report was where students were fundraising for Palestine. They were reprimanded because they were told you should be fundraising for both sides, for victims in Israel and Palestine, where I can imagine if any student raised the fact that we should be fundraising for Russia as well as Ukraine, they would probably receive a sanction for that.
This report about schools staging events and activities in support of the conflict in Ukraine.
A survey by CAGE shows that 96% of British schools have proactively engaged with the calls to support for Ukraine. The figures are in stark comparison to the treatment of Palestine last year, where pupils and staff were treated punitively for attempting to express solidarity. 80 survey responses mentioned schools promoting motifs off the Ukraine flag, such as encouraging children to wear blue and yellow for non-uniform days or hoisting the Ukraine flag on school grounds. The openness with schools have expressed forceful solidarity with Ukraine belies the excuses that pupils and parents, largely Muslim, were subject to by schools last year to justify ignoring the war on Gaza. Indeed, some respondents spoke to this disparity in explicit terms. The school organized the collection for Ukraine, but we were unable to do the same for Palestine as it was, quote, political as it was due to religion. We asked to do an assembly or put posters up and fundraise for Palestine, and they said no, but they're doing it all for Ukraine. But the Cage research also uncovered two further worrying findings. The first is that the government has been encouraging teachers to use resources on disinformation via the website Educate Against Hate. One resource was titled Be Internet Citizens, developed as a collaboration between YouTube and the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, the ISD. ISD is a strongly Zionist organization which has been heavily involved in counter-extremism work and is funded by major NATO states and by regime change foundations. The second finding is that some schools may have been directly encouraging support for armed violence in Ukraine and actively involved in supporting Nazi-adjacent Ukrainian groups. A key instance has been support for the Association of Ukrainians in Great Britain, the AUGB, the largest representative group for Ukrainians in the country. But the AUGB has direct and explicit links to the Ukrainian far right, stretching back to its inception. These include the ultra-nationalist fascist organization, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, and its paramilitary organization, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, the UPA, as well as regularly celebrating a notorious leader of the OUN, Stepan Bandera. These developments are a direct encouragement of far-right, indeed Nazi ideology in British schools, encouraging a hostile environment for Muslim, Palestinians and other people of colour.
David, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue sounds innocuous enough, doesn't it? I mean, can you explain what it's up to here?
Well, the ISD is a really quite large organisation for a think tank. It was funded founded by Lord Weidenfeld, who, of course, famously served in the first Israeli government back in the day and then came to Britain and has funded a huge number of Zionist think tanks and lobby groups over the years. He's now dead, but the group continues to be strongly Zionist, and the people in charge of it remain strongly Zionist and fund other key Zionist organisations. But it's also involved in doing work on disinformation. Now, what it means by disinformation is information which is critical of Western foreign policy. And you can see the kind of straight connection there is between that and its work on Ukraine or Russia and its funders. It's funded by something like six or seven different NATO states, yeah, as well as by a whole range of regime change fundraisers, including the Soros foundations. And it's engaged, you know, pretty straightforwardly in propaganda, by which it says anyone who tells the truth about what's happening in Ukraine is actually just regurgitating Russian propaganda. So it's itself a propagandist body, and it should have nothing to do with the Department for Education. It shouldn't be having its work recommended. It's actually an active propaganda organisation.
Mm. Well, I also asked Fahad what he thought about schools allowing support for Ukraine but vetoing kids mentioning Palestine, and what he thought the reasons were for the double standards.
There is definitely a double standard at play here between the Israel-Palestine and Russia-Ukraine conflict. Any child can see that. Children, straight away, we've had reports of children questioning their schools as to why there was a double standard. When they were asked to bring in Ukrainian flags, they remembered what happened when they brought in Palestinian flags, and they raised that with their schools. Parents raised it with the schools as well.
David, tell us about this far-right Ukrainian group that seems to be infiltrating some British schools.
Well, I mean, this was one of the extraordinary findings, I thought, of the Cage research, is that some schools are actually going directly to this Association of Ukrainians in Great Britain, in existence since 1946, and yeah, seeming to have a very, very long history with the Ukrainian far-right, you know, back to the time of Stepan Bandera, mm, the big hero of the Azov Battalion, etc., of today. And so it's extraordinary to see that, to see that there seems to be no due diligence. The schools that have engaged in this, no due diligence. They're actually actively engaging with Nazi and Nazi-adjacent or organisations and ideas in British schools, which must be against the law. And secondly, also engaged as a result of that in building support for sending money to support the armed conflict there, directly to support military equipment and the like, which cannot be right. I mean, we imagine if people were doing the same, saying we should be raising money to buy military equipment for Hamas.
Indeed.
Now, of course, that would be a completely different matter, actually, in terms of resistance to the Israeli occupation. But we see this with Ukraine, that there's literally no criticism of the idea that we might directly support armed violence from schools, including primary schools. Extraordinary.
No, indeed. And just remind us very briefly about the atrocities that Stepan Bandera perpetrated.
So Bandera was the leader of the Ukrainian nationalists, the proto-Nazis, who collaborated with the Germans when they occupied part of what was then Ukraine. And was involved in pogroms against the Jews and indeed against Poles and travellers, gypsy travellers as well. Mm. At the time, hundreds of thousands of people died.
Yes, essentially, it's his hands.
Yeah, that's right. And these people were pursued by the Soviets up until 1959. It wasn't until 1959 that they were eventually eliminated, and to use the phrase of today, denazified.
Sure, sure. Well, finally, I asked Fahad what he thought the government and the courts should be doing about these worrying trends.
The problem, I guess, is the government itself. I mean, the government has its own political position, and let's not be naive. That's not going to change in the short term, or possibly even the medium term. So as long as the government's got its agenda, it's going to try to propagate that as much as it can. And when it comes to schools, what it cannot do is force those schools to adopt that position. And we hope that through this litigation that we made that clear, and the new guidance that was issued in the midst of the litigation offers a more nuanced approach and specifically excludes from its examples of extreme political positions that schools should not engage with those organizations that publicly reject Israel's right to exist.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, as unfortunately we're out of time again. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. These days, the energy crisis in Europe has become the most important topic in Western media. According to The Economist, the European economy is definitely going into recession, and industry is also under heavy pressure. The price of gas and electricity has increased 10 to 20 times, 10 and 20 times respectively. The service sector in Europe is also likely to stagnate in the coming months, and the real estate and transportation sectors will face severe problems as consumers are making themselves ready for a long and cold winter. Experts say concerns about the occurrence of riots, theft and even crime, and suicide in European countries are high due to the increase in the energy prices and soaring inflation. We have taken a look at some of the world media for further details. Please stay with us. German newspaper Der Spiegel wrote, according to a top European Union official, the European Union is bracing for a recession in the wake of skyrocketing gas prices and soaring inflation, as the coming winter is likely to be one of the worst in history. Paolo Gentiloni, the European Union's economics commissioner, recently said the recession cannot be ruled out amid sharp cuts in Russian energy supplies to Europe. Paolo Gentiloni was quoted as saying, "The current inflation will throw our economy into turmoil, and the coming winter could be one of the worst in history." He added, "We're experiencing unprecedented uncertainty." The senior European Union official also hinted at the need for some EU countries to ration gas consumption. He noted, "It depends on what decisions Russian President Vladimir Putin makes and how we ourselves behave. It is already necessary to save energy." Also recently, the president of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, said if gas prices continue to skyrocket, that would be a recessionary factor for the European countries. Christine Lagarde said the downside scenario for 2023 foresees negative growth in the case of a total shutdown of all Russian gas supplies to Europe and energy rationing in the Eurozone. According to Eurostat data, as prices rise at the highest pace for half a century, Eurozone inflation is poised to be 9.1% in August, up from 8.9% in July. It comes after Russia announced an indefinite shutdown of its main gas pipeline, the Nord Stream pipeline to Europe, that saw a daily flow of 170 million cubic meters of gas supply. Russian President Vladimir Putin said recently that Gazprom could restart gas flows to Europe via the key Nord Stream 1 pipeline if illegal US and European sanctions were eased and Russia received the turbines that it needed. Actuary website covers the same issue from a different angle. New analysis suggests general insurers can expect slower premium growth in Europe over the next 3 years, as rising inflation impacts the ability of policyholders to pay higher prices. The forecast by data and analytics firm Global Data indicate that general insurance claim payouts in Europe will grow by 5.1% in 2022, whereas premiums will increase at a lower rate of 4.9%. A similar trend is expected up to 2025, suggesting a negative impact on the profitability of insurers. This is in stark contrast to what was recorded in 2020, when claim payouts grew by just 1% and the premiums increased by 4.1%. The analysis comes after inflation in Europe jumped to 8.9% in July, which was the highest level seen in the last 25 years. Saurabh Kumar Sahu, senior insurance analyst at Global Data, explained, "This was initially due to the prolonged economic impact of COVID-19, but has been further exacerbated by the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the resulting supply chain disruptions in 2022. Adding, "Following this, the price for the average claim has increased, impacting most general insurance lines, especially property, motor insurance, and specialty insurance. Rising raw material prices, disruptions in supply, and labor shortages are expected to shoot up the average cost of claims for both commercial and household property insurance. As a result, property insurance claims are expected to grow by 6.4% in 2022, with premiums growing by 5.6%. Saurabh Kumar Sahu, a senior insurance analyst at Global Data, said, "Rising inflation and the cost of living crisis will not only lead to higher insurance rates and tougher conditions for the market, but will also push policyholders towards underinsurance and keep general insurers' profitability under pressure." The British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. The Guardian reports, according to European Central Bank's policymakers, interest rates across the Eurozone must continue to ratchet upwards to tackle rapidly rising inflation. The European Central Bank's call to prioritise the fight against inflation with further increases in the cost of borrowing came after it raised interest rates by an unprecedented 0.75% on Thursday, 8th of September, to 1.25%. The ECB warned that Eurozone inflation was at its highest rate in almost half a century in August, at 9.1%, up from 8.9% in July, and at risk of becoming entrenched. Peter Kazimir, Slovakia's central bank chief, who sits on the European Central Bank's governing body, said, "Inflation remains unacceptably high. The priority now is to continue vigorously the normalisation of monetary policy." Peter Kazimir's remarks were widely interpreted as a call for further significant increases in borrowing costs, despite the likelihood it will significantly slow the 19-member currency bloc's economic recovery. Echoing his words, the Dutch Central Bank President, Klaus Knot, said, "Slowing growth was a necessary side effect of the fight against inflation." Klaus Knot said, "We expect inflation to keep rising in the coming months, so that means we only have one problem on our plate, inflation." He adds, "That will mean we will have to slow economic growth at least a bit to reduce inflation." European governments feel threatened over the day-by-day worsening situation that would result in mass sufferings this winter. Along with the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict, drought and rising temperatures in several parts have also aggravated the crisis in the European continent. Meanwhile, the fear of energy shortage has drawn consumers to wood and caused them to store wood before the winter. In France, for example, with an increase of 28.5% in energy prices, the condition is so bad that people are collecting firewood to use wood-burning fireplaces to brace themselves for the upcoming winter. This has also increased the demand for firewood. In Germany, the year-ahead contract for electricity reached 995 euros per megawatt hour, while the French equivalent surged past 1,100 euros. In Britain, on the other hand, Britain has seen mass strikes during the last weeks in the transport sector, in shipping and postal industries, as workers demanded hikes in wages as they are not able to deal with the rising expenses. A disruptive chain of decrease in supplies that has led to a domino effect in the continent is now setting its feet into other untouched industries.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the war in Ukraine with TV correspondent Johnny Miller. But first, this brief analysis.
It is said that the first victim of war is the troop. And this seems to be especially the case as it relates to the war in Ukraine. Very rarely have the global consumers of Western media been subjected to such a high level of propaganda, ridiculously pro-Ukrainian and viciously anti-Russian, in line with NATO objectives. Western news outlets have taken upon themselves to basically be the public relations arm of NATO. The level of public shaming and gaslighting of experts, academics, and journalists in the media is so intense that there are virtually no Western politicians courageous enough to publicly disagree with the warmongering and hype, not to mention the fact that right at the beginning of the war, all Russian media were banned in the West by the Western champions of liberal democracy and free speech, lest the so-called wrong facts get transmitted to Western citizens and mess up NATO's plans for a long, attritional war with Russia. In this environment, Press TV has tried to conduct fair reporting by reporting the facts from both sides, some of which expose the lies and false narratives being propagated by Western media in their zeal to be of service to Western military and security organizations. Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller reported the facts as he saw it, including crimes committed by the neo-Nazi elements of the Ukrainian military, as well as reports that paint a somewhat different picture of the mood and morale among Ukrainian civilians than the rosy caricature often portrayed in Western media. Johnny Miller's reward for his excellent journalistic effort is that he was placed on a so-called kill list of Ukrainian neo-Nazis, which includes personal information and encourages people to murder the people on the list, an Italian journalist already falling victim to this outrage. The evil combination of neo-Nazi fanatics being sponsored by the suit and tie-wearing terrorists of NATO make it very difficult to discuss and possibly find a peaceful solution to this devastating war. The comedian president of Ukraine seems to have realized that there will not be a military victory in the cards for Ukraine against Russia. But he might also be in too deep with his neo-Nazi NATO cabal to be able to do anything other than what he's ordered to do. Otherwise, he too might one day end up on the Ukrainian neo-Nazi kill list.
Johnny Miller, thank you for joining us on Insight. I want to spend our time today talking about the war in Ukraine. As you know, our program, we try to look at the historic, the strategic context of the news that we witness on a daily basis, something that unfortunately is no longer there in Western media, in mainstream media. But before we get to that, you know, the rule in journalism is that the journalist should never himself or herself become the story. But unfortunately, it seems that some people don't play by those rules. And it seems, unfortunately, that they put your name on this so-called kill list. It's even nasty to even say it, but unfortunately, that seems to be what has happened. We shouldn't act like nations don't have their own national interests. We shouldn't act like because there was European integration, because there is this kind of solidarity within the Western countries, that somehow, you know, whatever is in America's interest is also in Germany's interest, or whatever is in America's interest is also in Sweden or Britain's interest. Of course, you said, you know, I'm going to out myself as a Scottish nationalist, so I would say the Scots don't have to worry about the oil. They have enough oil and gas for themselves. But a place like Germany, obviously, is a major problem if they can't have normal relations with Russia, because their entire industry, it's not only oil and gas, it's aluminum, it's various raw materials that are the basis of this mighty German, you know, industrial system that exists there. So yeah, I think maybe the story, and this is good when we have these kind of conversations, we get to some new insight, which is the point of our program, is that maybe, like you said, this is going to have a much more devastating effect on these Western European countries who are. And again, I think we should distinguish between the people and the elites. I think most people in Europe are keenly aware of that this is just wrong. Yes, they might not, they don't agree with Russian invasion. They sympathize with the Ukrainian people. It's not that they are on the Russian side, but they realize that it is not in their interest to become this kind of, you know, cannon fodder for NATO or America's, you know, imperial plans or strategic plans.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'll tell you when I go back to London. I haven't been there for a while. But before I went, I mean, there seems to be the propaganda. Noam Chomsky and John Pilger said a couple of weeks ago, since the Vietnam War, all these years they've been imposing, they've never seen the propaganda like in this war, in any else. And I think it's largely working. I mean, I'll get back to you when I get back to London, but there seems to be, as I said, no serious debate about NATO's involvement of this whitewashing of the extremists. And I expect this propaganda is having a huge effect. I mean, now Ukraine is largely off the news, I think. It was big for the first month. Now it's largely off. So I wonder, actually, just how many people know much about Ukraine. But I think what you will see, of course, is the further gas prices go up and food prices go up, and the further that's linked to Ukraine, which is a big part of why they're going up,
exactly.
Then, of course, I think people, for their own self-interest, might start to wonder, why are we in Ukraine? And then you may well see more reporting about the kind of stuff that I'm reporting on. If you see policy-making change, you may well see some of the journalists being sent to East Ukraine and Donbass and starting to tell the whole story. Well, you know, maybe there are some pro-Russian people there, or maybe there are some extremists. Maybe we shouldn't be sending weapons. Maybe we should push for peace. So you might see the media narrative change if you see the policy, government policy change.
Well, you know, I think this is an interesting thing we can speculate about, which is that there's a desperate attempt, it seems to me, by NATO, which is basically an American military organization. I mean, it's true, it has all these different countries that are in it, but everybody knows that it's, you know, basically America's military coalition that it can command to do whatever it wants. It seems to me that the defeat in Afghanistan was really something that was an existential problem for these people. They had come in and said that, you know, NATO is going to be, Afghanistan is going to be the great project that proves that NATO is still relevant after the Cold War, after the demise of the Soviet Union. And after 20 years, you know, it was just shambles. It was just a mess, as we all remember the way that they fled from Kabul. And it seems to me, and you know, I think I have reason to be cynical and not have a good view of Western elites and not be optimistic about that they want good for themselves and for their own people, based on what we've seen from them. I think there was an idea that, hey, you know what, we're going to revive NATO here, we're going to give it a new sort of life, we're going to try to, you know, make it relevant and keep it relevant, maybe bring in some new people. You know, you got Sweden and Russia, Sweden and Finland talking about doing these things, which is very strange. Sweden and Finland were historically always neutral. Even during the Cold War, they were not part of NATO, which was probably more threatening than we have today. You know, Russia, it's very unlikely Russia is going to attack Finland or Sweden. I mean, it's almost, you know, you know, it's virtually impossible that they would do that. So I think we can't underestimate the level to which they're going to desperately try to keep this going, even if the people in the West don't want it to go on. We saw it with the Iraq War.
I think you're right with the difference between the elites and the people. We're seeing that many examples of it. Increasingly, elites just don't seem to care about the people's living standards. But and so they may well care more about this grand policy. This one of the propaganda debates about in this war has been what have Russia's aims been? The West likes to say that Russia tried to take Kiev, failed. So it's this great big victory from Ukraine. I was in Kiev at the start of the war.
Please tell us about it.
So the Russian troops were surrounded Kiev, not entirely surrounded. They allowed people to get in and out through a train route. But there was hardly any strikes, maybe four or five strikes. If you're going to try to take Kiev, it's clear that Russia's aims are to take over the pro-Russian areas of Ukraine. I think Russia may well have learned their lesson from the Afghanistan in the 90s, or indeed the Americans in Afghanistan. The Americans were in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now who's back in power? The Taliban. It's very hard for a country to rule or take over a country when you have a hostile population. Russia is trying to take over the Donbass region, the southern region, Crimea, of course, annexed 8 years ago. And right. The vast majority of people in Crimea are Russian, so they have no internal problems.
Yeah, I mean, Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian, gave it to the Ukraine during his rule in the Soviet Union.
Sure. Donbass is the vast majority Russian, so where I was in Donbass, Russia doesn't have any problems controlling those territories. In the southern region, just above Crimea, that's more complicated. Right. Russia's taken that area in order to safeguard Crimea. Crimea, of course, crucial for their geopolitics. They can control Absolutely. The Black Sea from there, which is very important to them. I was in that area. There it's a lot more mixed. I went to the streets. I interviewed a dozen groups of people. About 25% of those people, I'd say, were openly pro-Russian. 25% were openly pro-Ukrainian, although some of them asked to see my British press credentials before answering because they're worried about the authorities.
Right.
But interesting, about 50% of the people said they've got Russian family, Ukrainian family, and they just want peace.
Right.
Now, since the Russians took over that area, you may well have seen more Ukrainians leave,
mm-hmm.
And so it's become more of a pro-Russian area. But there's also terrorist attacks or insurgent attacks by Ukrainians, so it's much more mixed. If Russia was to take over the rest of Kiev or the Western Kiev, it would be very hard for them to control that in
absolutely.
The long term. Just that Afghanistan's found out in the Americans found out in Afghanistan. Very hard for them to do that with a hostile population. And so it's not Russia's desire to do that, but my fear is that the Americans may well want that to happen. They want to drag Russia into a long war here. So if you keep arming Ukraine, Russia's, and it's openly said it, it's going to have to go further. And so that's why you might see this war drag on for years,
mm-hmm.
rather than anybody suing for peace. For a long-term NATO strategy to try and drag Russia into a new Afghanistan, if you will. Russia's invasion of Afghanistan in the 80s is largely attributed to bring down the Soviet Union. And I think that's what NATO's plan is here as well, to bring Russia in to a new Afghanistan. And that's why Russia wants to keep to the pro-Russian areas, but they may well be forced to go further by NATO.
So you don't see any signs within Ukraine, I'm talking about the Ukrainian side, not the Russian speakers or the ethnic Russians, on the Ukrainian side of them wanting to somehow get to a peace agreement or some sort of end of hostilities?
So the Russian side or the Ukrainian
side? The Ukrainian side.
On the Ukrainian side, I think the people, once again, you ask the people. I'd be fascinated if you did a referendum in Ukraine today, either including the pro-Russian areas or not including the pro-Russian areas. If you did a referendum in Ukraine before the Russian invasion started, you asked the Ukrainian people, would you be happy to give away Crimea and Donbass, or there's going to be a Russian invasion? I think we'd be very interested in the answer to that. I think most people in Ukraine, this I'm just speculating, but mm-hmm. I do have some contacts there. For Crimea and Donbass, pro-Russian areas, you know, most Ukrainians, as long as they're not ultra-nationalists, would say, let's just let them have that. But then you've got this area above Crimea, which is more complicated. Many Ukrainians saying, well, we give them Crimea and Donbass, but what about this area, Kherson, for example,
right.
which may well have been majority Ukrainian before Russia got involved. So that's when it becomes a lot more complicated. But if you ask the Ukrainian people now, do you want to negotiate for peace, even if it means ceding territory? I think the majority, I think, would say yes. But that's why you have the government and the nationalists who are very much pushing for. I mean, as a journalist here in Ukraine, I spend a lot of time on the Telegram channels. Okay, that's a new sort of way of journalism. You have to spend a lot of time on the Telegram channels of soldiers and civilians posting videos from the front lines or posting videos of what's going on the streets of West Ukraine. I can't tell you how many videos I saw of conscription officers of the Ukrainian military going into beaches, going in the streets, literally chasing Ukrainian citizens to hand them out conscription notices. You have the old men, old men of military age, 18 to 60, are not allowed to leave the country. They're right. effectively prisoners in the country and increasingly being forced to fight. And when they do join up, they've hardly got any military experience, being sent to the front line with almost no weapons. Once again, I can't tell you how many videos I've seen of Ukrainian soldiers with their whole company behind them, reading out a statement to President Zelensky saying, you sent us here with no weapons, we don't want to fight, we refuse to fight, we're going home, essentially. I can't tell you how many videos I've seen of that. You don't see any of that in Western media, by the way.
Yeah, very interesting. None of that is in Western media. It's all this kind of propaganda, you know.
It's incredible. I did one story about it, I think. But I can't say how many videos I've seen. And these are Ukrainians posting it. So it's not propaganda. These are Ukrainian soldiers posting these videos to President right. Zelensky. And I've seen countless numbers of them. And the Western media just says Ukrainian morale is sky high. It's not sky high. It may be sky high amongst some of the nationalists or the people at the back. But against and it's poor people who are sent to these front lines mainly. Forced to fight, sent to the front lines, and hundreds at one stage, I'm not sure about the numbers now, hundreds were dying every day under Russian artillery. It's an absolute slaughter. And this is mainly a proxy war now. So Ukrainian people are being used as cannon fodder for an American proxy war in Ukraine. And it's shocking. And so many people still in the West say, stand for Ukraine. Well, standing for Ukraine, continue to send them weapons, is literally sending them in to die. And I can't believe how there's not more people pushing for a peaceful negotiated settlement. And one of the reasons there's not is because of the level of propaganda. And also the propaganda making Russia out to be evil people, not just evil government, but evil people. Absolutely. They must be stopped. They're going to invade Eastern Europe. Russia's not going to invade Eastern Europe unless it's pushed to. It's trying to take over Crimea because that's what's important to them and throw Russian areas. But the level of propaganda in order to keep sending money to Ukraine so more Ukrainians die, it's shocking.
Okay, Johnny, so let's talk about the future a little bit, because, I mean, it's pretty bleak what's going on right now, both in terms of what's happening in the Ukraine and the areas where there's conflict, but also, as we were talking, also what's happening to the public in Western Europe and the political and the social environment that we have, this kind of, you know, suffocating, you know, propaganda. So let's try to look to the future a little bit. So let's start with what you were just talking about, which is the idea that maybe it's not sustainable for the Ukrainians to continue much longer. And, you know, everything I've seen from the Russian side points to the fact that they are willing to compromise if they can get, you know, in terms of having the independence of those Donbass republics and Crimea. So if you could give us a little insight on that.
I think, first of all, I don't think Russia's interested in negotiations at the moment either, because essentially if NATO continues to send them weapons, increasingly very high-tech, high-powered weapons that can hit Donetsk or hit Crimea, then Russia doesn't really see a point in negotiating. It's said clearly that if NATO keeps sending these weapons and threatening our cities, we're just going to have to take more of Ukraine. You've got the major cities of Kharkiv and Odessa. I've asked frequently Russian journalists or politicians, do they want to take these cities? Kharkiv and Odessa do have large Russian minorities in them. So if they were to take these cities, with the amount of Ukrainians that flee, they could well be able to control them in the long term. It wouldn't be like Kiev, where the overwhelming population is hostile. So they might want to take these cities as well. But if NATO continues to send weapons to Ukraine, I think Russia will just continue to fight. And maybe that's NATO's aim. Do NATO politicians really care about the death of Ukrainian people or the destruction of Ukrainian cities? If there were hundreds of British or American soldiers dying every single day in Ukraine, you'd have absolute outcry about it. But there's no outcry in Britain because they're Ukrainians. It doesn't really matter to them.
Well, do you think the Ukrainian government can sustain it? I mean, obviously, well, we know that the NATO doesn't care about the Ukrainians, but does it reach a point where the Zelensky government is no longer able to continue this?
Well, you've just had in the last few days a purge by Zelensky of very important figures. I think the head of the SBU, a former friend of his, has been kicked out. Some other high-ranking figures. So we're not quite sure why this is. The Americans have also just warned about Zelensky's security. Some analysts have said the Americans essentially threatened him.
Right.
And this is increasingly, you expect to see much more repression in Ukraine. And this is all part of, we started this conversation talking about a kill list. Well, in Ukrainian society, it's basically impossible to criticize the government or to criticize the nationalists because it's so dangerous there. So you're going to see so much more repression in Ukraine, forcing people to do what the government says. I also can't tell you how many videos I've seen online of women in Ukraine standing up to these conscription officers or posting their own videos saying you're taking our men to the front line.
Correct.
And I'm seeing increasingly angry video posts, particularly from women in Ukraine as well, and men, just saying this, we can't keep sustaining this. So you ask a good question of whether Ukraine can keep sustaining it. I think the NATO has so much control over Ukraine. I mean, NATO could change the Ukrainian government whenever it wanted. They fund and arm the Ukrainians. They basically control.
So do you think it would be correct to say that is it related to the person of Zelensky, or is it not that important whether he remains or he goes?
I don't think it's that important. I mean, Zelensky isn't an ultra-nationalist. I mean, I actually think he's quite a decent guy, to be honest with you. before he became president. He said a famous interview in which he said, just let the pro-Russians speak Russian. Just let them do it. Why do we have to force them not to? He did a lot of work in stopping corruption or helping to stop corruption before right. The Russian invasion. So I think Zelensky's quite a decent guy, a reasonably moderate guy, but he doesn't really have much power here. You've got the Americans on one side and the ultra-nationalists on the other, and he's caught in the middle, having to do whatever he's told, frankly. So you may well see more purges or maybe a change of government, but NATO is clearly determined to keep this war going on as long as possible. But as you say, there may well be a breaking point at some point in which the Ukrainians simply can't sustain it. But whether this war is going to last another few months or when Afghanistan lasted 20 years, so that's my fear.
Well, you know, I think you're right. I mean, I don't think it's going to be 20 years. It might be maybe a year or two. But the way I see it, that, you know, Russia is not crumbling. All the sanctions haven't worked. They've actually backfired on the West. Russia is doing okay. You know, it's not under pressure. You saw we recently had President Putin and President Erdogan come to Tehran for the big summit about Syria. So it doesn't seem to be that the Western policy, the Western strategy has been working against Russia. Tell us what the mood is. You're across the border. What is the mood in Russia on all this issue?
Yeah, before going to Donbass, the Russians, of course, call this a special military operation. Well, for people in Russia, this does very much feel like a special military operation on the edges of the empire, if you like. It's not really affecting Russian people all that much. Yes, the sanctions are damaging. Certainly some people who work in trade with the West, for example.
All right. So listen, Johnny, I want to conclude with going back to the West a little bit. And, you know, I want to also commend you and say thank you. You deserve some rest. You were in very difficult situations. You are now going to spend a little time resting. But before we end our conversation, let's go back to the West. We talked about the future in Ukraine. You talked about how in Russia it's not really affecting daily life. And we also talked about, you know, the idea that maybe the Europeans miscalculated. Do you feel that there is a chance, an opportunity, that there would be a movement in Western countries? Of course, each country is different. We don't want to generalize. Where you could see people, you know, starting to protest about this and trying to get this to end, because it seems it's going to have a bad effect on them, especially when it gets colder. And when, you know, they start feeling the problems in terms of prices and the effects it has on their daily life.
Well, the Russian media likes to make out that all these Western leaders are falling now with Boris Johnson, the Italian, and they like to think that it's all because of Ukraine. I think maybe some of it is. I do point out to a Russian journalist that Boris Johnson is scandal after domestic scandal, and that's the major reason he's fallen. But I think particularly when you see winter coming, and gas prices going up so much, I think you may well see a lot of people start saying, is this war really worth it? And increasingly politicians, particularly German, French, Emmanuel Macron is still on the phone to Putin all the time. Russia and Germany do have relations with Russia. So I think winter, you may well see an opportunity for European countries to say, look, we're not having any more of this. And without Russian and without French and German support, can the Americans and Brits go it alone in Ukraine and arming Ukraine? I'm not sure. But I think maybe when winter comes, you may well see another opportunity, if you like, for particularly European countries to question whether their continued support of Ukraine militarily rather than pushing for peace is really the right option for the European people.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, thank you so much for joining us. I know you were tired, but you took the time to have a conversation with us. Thank you very much. Get some rest, stay safe, and looking forward to more of your excellent reporting.
Thank you so much. And we're also going to open the window. It's got so hot in here. So that's the first thing I want to do. But thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Johnny Miller? The reality on the ground in Ukraine is very different than what is being portrayed in Western media. It is virtually impossible to rationally discuss this war and to suggest that NATO or